Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On April 21st, 2021, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Minerva Surgical, Inc. v. Hologic, Inc. The question before the court was whether a defendant in a patent infringement action who assigned the patent or is in privity with an assigner of the patent may have a defense of invalidity heard on the merits. Professor Daniel Ortiz, Michael J. and Jane R. Horovitz, Distinguished Professor of Law, and director of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law, joins us today to discuss this case's oral argument.
So first, the issue. I mean, it's a really classic one, but sort of displaced or located in sort of technical patent law. But the general issue is the extent to which a statutory provision overrides the common law, something that everyone is familiar with from law school. Here, in particular, it's whether 35 U.S.C. Section 282, which says, quote, invalidity shall be a defense in any action involving the validity or infringement of a patent, with the emphasis on the phrase in any action, abrogates the patent doctrine of assigner estoppel, which prevents an assignor from impeaching in district court proceedings the validity of a patent it assigned. Now, for those of you who aren't IP nerds, or maybe even patent nerds in particular, this may seem a very narrow parochial issue, but one acknowledgedly of some importance to patent practice and policy. And I want to argue that actually it turned out that view is wrong and show how the oral argument demonstrated as it veered from, say, stare decisis to close parsing of precedent to patent policy, patent meta policy, and law and economics, that there was a lot more sort of going on in the case, and there are many different perspectives from which to view it. And so I want to show that there's something in this case for everyone, and in fact, that's why my clinic students, who did most of the heavy lifting here in our briefing, found it so rewarding. It was also a case, I think, as the oral argument showed, where amici, and one in particular, had a big effect in defining the issues and sketching out the lines of analysis for the court. So first, the facts. They're pretty complex, so I'm just going to give you the simplified version of them. I think that's sufficient to understand what's going on. There's a guy, Trakai, an inventor who assigned his patent rights to a company that was ultimately taken over by Hologic. And then he went off and ultimately founded Minerva and created a device which competed with the one Hologic had patented based on his earlier work. Hologic then sued for infringement, and there was also, and I can talk about it later if you're interested, a parallel inter pares review proceeding going on. But I don't want to complicate it too much now. But at the trial, Minerva attacked the validity of the patent in defending against infringement, and Hologic asserted this doctrine of assigner estoppel against it, claiming that since Minerva and Trakai were in privity, Minerva could not impugn the validity of the patent. Now, the district court held that the doctrine applied and largely found against Minerva. And then on appeal to the Federal Circuit, Judge Stoll found that circuit precedent foreclosed Minerva's argument that Section 282 overrode the common law doctrine. Really interestingly, though, she also wrote a separate individual opinion, noting that the Federal Circuit's approach was somewhat contradictory, since it had held in another case, Arista, that the American Invents Act abrogated the doctrine of assigner estoppel in IPR proceedings. So she called for an en banc review, thinking that what's sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander, or at least they should be consistent, and noted the worry about the practical inconsistencies. Now, technically, this relevant section of the American Events Act, 35 U.S.C. Section 311A, is a little bit different. It doesn't use the in any proceeding, any action language. It says, quote, a person who is not the owner of a patent may file an IPR. So you could technically argue that one provision could abrogate the doctrine where the other could not. But many people thought that, you know, it should be applied consistently. Now, the parties filed cross petitions for rehearing en banc before the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit denied them both. Minerva then filed a petition for certiorari in the Supreme Court, and Hologic filed a cross petition. And the Supreme Court granted Minerva's and denied Hologic's. Now, in the briefing, Minerva took the position that the statute overrode the common law doctrine. Hologic, of course, took the opposite position. And Minerva then also argued that if the court retained a signer estoppel, it should limit it by requiring express representation and assignee reliance, which in effect would largely assimilate the doctrine to traditional equitable estoppel. So as framed by the parties, it was largely an issue of statutory construction, and in particular, whether the statute abrogated the common law. Now, it wasn't actually talked about much directly in these terms, but you could say that the parties' arguments were joined on the canon of statutory construction that statutes and derogation of the common law should be strictly construed, or the canon that Congress is generally presumed to legislate against the background law, and whether those applied or not. And as you would imagine, that kind of inquiry raised a lot of issues like how specific does the statute have to be to override the common law? How settled does the common law have to be? How important does a common law policy have to be? Things like that. Now, the amici actually briefed it somewhat differently. There's most discussion of the United States' brief, which offered an intermediate position. The United States put forward a proposal that the doctrine should be retained but modified in two critical ways. It should apply, in the United States' view, only where there was quote-unquote valuable consideration for the assignment and when the rights assigned were, quote, materially identical to the claims that were being litigated over. And there were other amici which helped shape the argument. I think it's fair to say that they were less important, and we were one of those. Now, the oral argument, as I said before, is really interesting. The court talked about everything that you could imagine pretty much, and the three attorneys did a great job. The most embarrassing moment came at the very end when the Chief Justice tried to end the argument, forgetting that Rob Hochman, who represented Minerva, had not yet had a chance to offer up his rebuttal. It showed a bench that was surprisingly well prepared for what you might have thought was a pretty much technical, down-in-the-weeds issue. And perhaps even more surprisingly, the bench was really engaged. In short, it was a good example of the Supreme Court doing what you hope that it would usually do. Now, they talked about, as I said, from several different perspectives. Now, so the parties, in their discussion of how as the parties framed the issue, there was lots of talk about how settled a signer estoppel was, whether the court, Supreme Court and lower courts had moved away from it or settled it more firmly in a series of cases that found some exceptions with it and abrogated a different doctrine called licensee estoppel. There are questions, particularly from Justice Thomas, about whether other common law doctrines, particularly of claim and issue preclusion, would also be derogated from under the petitioner's theory. And I think, you know, these were all pretty much expected from the briefing, but they were handled well, I thought, by both the attorneys and the justices. More surprisingly, several of the justices raised issues of stare decisis. So, for example, if the law was settled as the respondents claim, they asked, could the court now overrule it, or is that something that Congress had to do? And Justices Alito and Kagan seemed particularly interested in this large background issue. And in the case of some justices, I think maybe Justice Kagan in particular, it seemed that the shadow of stare decisis as a larger doctrine and its roles in other potential role in other cases might affect somewhat how the court ends up looking at the case. The Chief Justice asked two questions right off the block, and I think those questions show the wide range of the inquiry. His first question was one of metapolicy, that is taken back to fundamentals. He said, you know, which party's view was more consistent with promoting the progress of science and the useful arts? And this brought up the issue, among other things, of the proper perspective to take in the case, sort of whether it should be ex post or ex ante. Ex post meaning, well, invalidating bad patents are a bad thing, so the law should strive to invalidate them. The ex ante perspective being more, you have to worry about settling property rights. The second question he asked was very doctrinal specific and practical. He asked Rob Hochman, who was representing Minerva, how do you feel about the government's approach? Several justices kept coming back to this, focusing on each of the two parts of the government's proposed test. Now, if you remember, the first part was that the assignment had to involve, quote unquote, valuable consideration. And several justices seemed to be interested in whether employee inventors would be covered, meaning employees who worked for inventors who worked for a corporation rather than inventors who sort of worked by themselves. And what was most interesting about that is it seemed that it might cut both ways with different ways with different justices. Justice Gorsuch, for example, thought that it was a good thing that employee inventors not be covered, and sort of mentioned David and Goliath, things like that. And he thought that this applying it to employee inventors might actually impede innovation. And I think, you know, he was largely jogged in that direction by an amicus brief that was submitted by a very good amicus brief that was submitted by a group of law professors. Some other justices, I'm thinking here of particularly the Chief Justice, seem to think, well, if it is important that employee inventors actually be covered. So we'll see, you know, which way that goes. The other bit of the government's test was that the rights assigned had to be, quote unquote, materially identical to the claims that were later being litigated over. And here there were a lot of questions about how that would work in practice, whether it would explode litigation, meaning that you'd have to have litigation within litigation about how similar the claims were. Justice Barrett, in particular, asked whether this would involve a battle of the experts. Other justices thought that it was important, maybe, Justice Kagan in particular, and was worried about claims expanding too much beyond what the assigner originally thought. And several were very interested in how much distance there was in practice between Minerva and the government's view. So a lot of questions asked about that. Several justices also asked law and economic questions concerning incentives that would be created by each of the rules. The Chief Justice's initial question, for example, did that. And Justice Alito asked a question about whether Minerva's proposed rule, which would abolish assigner estoppel, could be contracted around. And there were two justices whose thinking or questions surprised me a little, because they were thinking very hard about changed circumstances and how the law would change, and these larger questions of how you handle a doctrine that might be settled when everything around it or some of the things around it have moved. So, for example, Justice Sotomayor asked questions about how this doctrine surrounding assigner estoppel had changed since it was adopted in or recognized in the 1920s. And she pointed out that issues that once sounded in claim construction now sounded more in validity, and how that might make that change in doctrinal analysis might make a difference. And Justice Breyer, on the other hand, asked an even larger question, I think, about how changes in employment markets, complexity of inventions, and the nature of invention itself might, since the time of Westinghouse, the case it recognized, where the Supreme Court recognized assigner estoppel, might make a difference. I know the bottom line is what you're interested in. You all want to know whether I think the petitioner or respondents will win. If I can say with great certainty, yes. But joking aside, this is a case that's particularly going to be hard to predict the winners or the losers. There's a lot of interest in the United States intermediate position. But on the other hand, there was a lot of really hard questioning about it. And different justices seem to be taking different positions on different parts of it. And it's possible for the court to adopt, I think, one part of it without adopting the other. So they could sort of drop the valuable consideration thing, or at least say that that doesn't mean that employee inventors aren't covered, but adopt the material identical part. They are, technically speaking, logically independent. So I think it's hard. They might adopt the government's proposal, but maybe not in the form that the government actually proposed it. And it looked like to me that Justice Gorsuch was the one who was most interested in abrogating the doctrine. And Justice Alito was the one least interested in abrogating it. And the others were pretty much hard to read. But again, that's just an individual view from someone who's not an IP expert. So, you know, my only advice, bottom line, stay tuned. Can't offer you any more certainty than that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.